After that first meeting with FBI investigators, I remember saying to Ted as we walked down the executive office building hallway back to the West Wing, I was surprised they didn't ask any substantive questions about what I might know, such as my conversations with Rove and Libby. The second meeting, I believe within a couple of weeks, was more targeted to what I might know. Neither meeting lasted much more than an hour. On December 30, 2003, Deputy Attorney General Jim Comey held a news conference at the Department of Justice. He announced that Attorney General John Ashcroft had recused himself from the investigation to avoid any appearance of conflict of interest. Comey then announced that he was naming a special prosecutor to oversee the leak investigation, Patrick J. Fitzgerald of Chicago. Fitzgerald was a highly regarded U.S. attorney who had a reputation for playing by the book and not being swayed by politics. Comey would not publicly discuss what had led to the decision to appoint the special counsel, except to say that an accumulation of facts over the previous several months had led to the decision. We don't want people that we might be interested in to know that we're interested in them. We also don't want to smear somebody who might be innocent and might not be charged. Ron Roos, the deputy to the head of the Justice Department's counter-espionage unit run by John Dionne, contacted me to arrange a time to meet with the team overseeing the investigation days before I was subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury. This time he asked if I would come alone, without anyone from the counsel's office. They preferred to talk to me alone, he indicated. I agreed. It made little difference to me one way or the other, although I appreciated hearing any feedback Ted was able to offer. I suspected that the investigative team wanted to keep information as closely held as possible as they proceeded with grand jury testimony. Early on, when I knew that I would be questioned in light of my public exonerations of Rove, Libby, and Abrams, I consulted my sister-in-law Stephanie McClellan, a former assistant district attorney in San Jose County, and my brother Dudley, a former clerk to a federal judge in Austin. Stephanie thought I should hire an attorney, even though I told her I did not know anything about the actual leak and that my role was limited to defending the White House and a couple of staffers after the fact. She perceptively pointed out that one can never know with certainty how words spoken might be construed or, worse, twisted, particularly in the context of a high-profile political investigation taking place during an election campaign. Dudley was noncommittal, just advising me as a brother and knowledgeable attorney on the pros of hiring a counsel. I would later ask him some basic substantive questions. He, his twin Bradley, and our eldest brother, Mark, may have picked on me growing up, but we are as close as any brothers can be. It was reassuring to know I could call on him when push came to shove. Colleagues thought I would be crazy not to hire an attorney. My deputy, Claire Buchan, a good friend who always looked out for me, basically said, "You have to hire an attorney." However, unlike many of my colleagues, I decided not to. I would tell investigators the truth, what I knew and what I remembered. With nothing to hide, with my only involvement coming in the aftermath of the leak, I felt comfortable with the decision. I don't mean to imply that my colleagues had something to hide. I'm just expressing my own feeling about the decision. So there I was that cold afternoon at the counter-espionage unit's office, several floors up in a Justice Department office building a few blocks from the White House. The conference room where we met was rather dark. The table was long. I saw the FBI agents who had previously interviewed me. Ron Roos introduced himself and the others present. I sat at the center of the table, across from the FBI agents, as I had in the previous meetings in the executive office building. Prosecutorial team members sat across the table as well as to my right. Fitzgerald was not in the room. While the previous meetings were straightforward and free of tension, this one started differently. Roos, who struck me as a serious and professional prosecutor, asked why I had exonerated Rove and Libby. Then he asked why I had not mentioned in the first meeting that Carl had spoken to Novak. Somewhat taken aback, I looked at one of the FBI agents and said, "I told you all when you asked me in the second meeting. You didn't ask about it in the first meeting." The agent said nothing. I thought, okay, they're playing tough to make sure I've told them everything I know or can recall and to make sure they have been thorough in seeking to learn the truth. A few minutes later, Peter Zeidenberg, a prosecutor from the Public Integrity Unit, entered the room. He introduced himself and seemed friendly. Professional and courteous, he quickly won my respect and trust. He played good cop to Roos's bad cop, indicating they were just trying to verify facts. He said he had seen many times how a witness's memory can be hazy when they're asked to recollect something that happened weeks or months earlier, and they just wanted to make sure they talked to me before my grand jury appearance. From his comments, I assumed he had been watching the initial discussion through what appeared to be a one-way window to my right, like one would see on the television show Law & Order. The meeting did not last much longer, and I was soon back at the White House to tend to my press secretary duties. Still, I wondered about their initial hard-edged approach. I felt a little unsettled, since I'd always been fully cooperative and open with them. I imagine they used the tactic to try to rattle those being questioned to see if they were being truthful. But I was comforted by the way the meeting had ended and felt they had reassured themselves I had nothing to hide. My appearance before a federal grand jury loomed before me. As I sensed was true of my colleagues, it weighed on my mind because of the high-stakes nature of the investigation. White House staffers long ago had stopped talking to one another about anything specific related to the leak investigation, including whether they'd been questioned and whether or not they'd hired an attorney. As with any high-profile Washington investigation, almost every White House aide going before the grand jury hired a lawyer out of an abundance of caution, even if they knew they were not involved. About the only thing I heard from colleagues was when they were headed to the grand jury, since the press was camped out by the grand jury room on a daily basis, and my colleagues did not want me to be blindsided by hearing it from a reporter first. Besides the silence we shared, we also sensed the same anxiety hanging over us. Somewhat unnerved, I wondered, was Stephanie's advice right? Should I be leaning on an attorney's advice? When you agree to work for the President of the United States, you don't picture being interrogated by the FBI or testifying before a grand jury under threat of perjury as part of the job description. The grand jury reportedly began hearing testimony in late January 2004. I was called to appear before the jurors on Friday afternoon, February 6th. I met Roos and one of the agents outside in the hallway in the upstairs area of the Prettyman Federal Courthouse building, near the Capitol on Pennsylvania Avenue. The afternoon weather was overcast and cold, although not unusually so for Washington that time of year. There was a little drizzle of rain now and then. They told me they would be ready for me soon and just to hang tight. Both were very friendly that afternoon. I sat in a chair in the barren, ill-lit hallway. I walked to the grand jury room through a narrow, short hall. Not quite sure what to expect, I entered the room and was directed to sit down in a wooden chair near the door at the short end of an L-shaped table. The prosecutorial team was to my right, facing the jurors, who was seated, theater style, in front and above us. At a guess, I'd say there were 35 or 40 jurors present. Across the way, a stenographer took down everything I was asked and said. Zeidenberg, the Public Integrity Unit prosecutor, asked the questions. Given where my chair was positioned, it was hard to know who exactly was present, and no introductions were made. Maybe Patrick Fitzgerald, the man I felt I now knew from all the press attention he'd received, but had not yet met, was there, but I did not see him. I was focused on answering questions. I turned slightly to the left, so I could partially face the jury while looking at Zeidenberg. The first thing he asked was whether it was correct that I was not represented by counsel. I indicated that I had not hired an attorney, but had just talked a few times with my brother Dudley. Then we went through a series of questions before the grand jury, most of which I had answered on previous occasions, including accounts of my conversations with Carl and Scooter, and the assurances they'd provided me that they were not involved in the leaking of Plame's identity. But there were a couple of questions they had not previously asked me. Zeidenberg asked whether I'd told Condi Rice that she should say that Carl was not involved before she went on the Sunday talk shows back on September 28, 2003. Rice hadn't, in fact, addressed this specific matter on those shows. I thought hard. I knew I'd spoken to Condi that Saturday, the same Saturday I'd called Rove after first learning that he'd spoken to Novak and he'd assured me he had not been involved in leaking classified information, as I usually did with administration officials ahead of their Sunday show appearances. It was a way to prep them for responses to likely questions and make sure everyone was on the same page. We knew the Sunday Post piece would likely prompt questions about possible White House involvement in the leak. Had I coached Condi on what to say about Karl Rove? I said I might have, but could not remember with certainty. I indicated it was more likely I told her what I'd said publicly and suggested she could refer back to what I'd said without getting into it herself.